Welcome to Civil Discourse. This podcast will use government documents to illuminate the workings of the American government and offer context around the effects of government agencies in your everyday life. And now your hosts, Nia Rogers, Public Affairs Librarian, and Dr. John Augenbaugh, Political Science Professor.
Morning, Augie.
Morning, Nia. How are you?
I'm good. How are you?
I am wrapping up the spring semester, so I am in what faculty refer to as the lower regions of grading. Notice I did not swear, but
yes.
I did make a Hades reference. But anyways, listeners, we have another guest joining the podcast this week. Dr. Patty Sopcich is here to talk to us about the National Zoo, okay? And Nia and I are both very excited about this because both Nia and I are zoo aficionados. I don't know how many zoos, Nia, you've been to. I've been to six, okay? And even one overseas, but that's for a different podcast. So Patty, good morning and a pleasure to have you join us.
Oh, thank you. Glad to be here.
I'm excited. Mostly what I've been to have been roadside attraction type zoos, which are not really zoos. They're more like a guy's yard where he has like a couple of llamas and a goat. And like, because my father could not resist driving past one of those on whatever vacation we were on. I'm like, look, kids, a crocodile zoo. And so we get out and look at, you know, six crocodiles, and they called that a zoo. So I've never been to the National Zoo, so I'm excited to hear about that. I do want to note for the record, if it's okay with everybody, before we get started, we are not going to discuss the ethics of zoos. There are many, many, many sides to that question. It can get quite heated and emotional, and we understand that, but we are taking the tack today that the zoo is a good thing. If that is not your cup of tea, then we welcome you to come back for another episode, but we're going to treat the zoo in a positive manner. Knowing that there are arguments to be, honest arguments and good arguments to be made on all sides. So just wanted to throw that out there for people who might get, you know, a third of the way in this episode and realize, oh, they're really happy about the zoo or whatever. But what I'm most interested in, I have to say, is the history of the zoo, the history of the National Zoo, not the history of zoos in general, because we didn't ask you to go back to like Greco-Roman Egyptian zoos of, you know, because that's, nobody can go to those. What we're trying to cover are things people can actually go to.
But before we get to the history, Patty, what turns you on to zoos?
I love animals. I just like watching animals. I love watching animals in their natural habitat. And I have to say that speaking of zoos, I went to the greatest zoo in the world. I went to the Galapagos Islands a couple of years ago. And you talk about a natural zoo. The animals rule in Galapagos. No one can touch them. They are absolutely sacred. And so they like take over buildings. They walk across cafeteria floors and no one can touch them. And that was the greatest experience. So that, I feel like I have been to the greatest zoo of all to see them. So yeah, just a real curiosity about animals. And I always want to know what they're thinking. What are they thinking about us?
So Patty, can I out you? Patty's a librarian, for listeners who didn't already know that, she's been here with us before, so you might already know that. But what you may not know about many librarians is that many of them have tattoos. And Patty has a rather special tattoo on her wrist, which is of?
The feet of the blue-footed booby. It's a rare bird that's actually, it's in the Pacific ocean. So it is around Hawaii, but really has most of the breeds are in Galapagos. And I just fell in love with him and I had his feet tattooed on my wrist. So
well done.
Yeah.
So I can honestly say I've never been to any zoo where I had the thing later tattooed upon my person. So yeah. Well done you, Patty. So this the National Zoo is part of located the Smithsonian, right? Oh, yeah. Sorry.
No. I was going to ask basically the same kind of question to you. So when we talk about the National Zoo, for our listeners, the National Zoo in the United States is located where?
In Washington, D.C. Yeah. And it is actually part of the Smithsonian Institute. So it has great support, and because of its affiliation with the Smithsonian, there's a lot of wonderful aspects of that, which is that the zoo is free to go to, just like the Smithsonian Museums. But it actually started, the first zookeeper, if you will, was William Temple Hornaday. And I think the funniest thing about him was that he was actually the chief taxidermist at the Smithsonian. So they enlist a taxidermist to run a zoo of live animals. I think that's a little dicey.
For some of our listeners, a taxidermist is a person who takes a recently deceased animal, not human, right? That's different. That's an undertaker. A recently deceased animal and restores it to something like its living appearance. Right, they're stuffed and they're mounted in ways that make them mostly, although sideshows back in the day did taxidermy and made up animals and then sold them, sold viewing to see them as, look, it's an octopus bird or whatever, where they just stuck two things together, which is gross. But real taxidermists.
We're only a few minutes into the podcast and Patty's already given us our title, or at least our subtitle. Okay. It's a little dicey. I mean the juxtaposition of a person who was a trained taxidermist, okay, becoming the head of our National Zoo. I'm like, yeah, that would be a little dicey. Okay. But anyways.
So yeah, he became the first head of the Department of Living Animals at the Smithsonian. I think they had to put the word living in there just to make sure he knew exactly what he was going to do. And so he actually brought 15 Northern American species to live on the National Mall in Washington. And that would later become the National Zoological Park. And in 1889, President Grover Cleveland officially signed the Act of Congress into law and created the National Zoological Park for the advancement of science and the instruction and recreation of the people. So Frederick Law Olmsted, he was a premier architect of the day, and he actually designed the zoo within the Rock Creek Park in Northwest Washington, D.C., and the zoo officially opened in 1891, so it's 130 years old. So that's pretty amazing that it's been around that long.
There are parks all over that Olmsted designed. Like there's one in North Carolina that he designed. I guess he just went around designing mostly parks and outdoor settings. I think he was some sort of like really big into landscape architecture and all that other kind of stuff. But let me just get this straight in my head. It was on the mall.
Yeah.
That is hilarious to me. You're just walking along and there's a herd of bison on the mall. Like,
hey, you gotta start somewhere.
Yeah, I guess. And it would be fun to put it there now. That would certainly be interesting. Okay, so how many animals?
Animals were back then? 185
species. Okay.
185 animals. Just 185 animals. Yeah. Didn't specify how many species, but when it opened in 1891, they had 185 animals.
So I noticed on your list that one of them is prairie dogs. Can I just say, I think that's hilarious. Prairie dogging on the mall. You know, whoop, did you hear that? What was that? Right. That I love when they do that. They're adorable. But it sounds like if it's 1891 and a lot of the animals that you have on the list here, lynx, bison, badgers, prairie dogs, foxes, deer, a lot of that wouldn't have been, well, the foxes and deer would have been in the east, but the other stuff would not. So they would have brought them, I guess, from the west, which would have been really cool for Americans in the capital, right? Like who probably never went very far west at that point.
To the prairie, yes. They've never seen
right,
the prairie.
To see a giant bison, right? Like that would have been really, I don't know. That would have been really cool.
Yeah, I agree. Shocking.
Yeah, you're walking along, there's a bison, and they're huge. Bison are huge. So who's in charge of the National Zoo?
Well, the Smithsonian owns it, and the animals are taken care of by the Department of Wildlife Health Sciences. So these are federal workers that go and take care of the animals, and they also work on breeding programs and also work with endangered species. So these are really talented people that are just really there for it. The word is really conservation of the species and care and feeding of the species. So they do an amazing job of that. And they did it all through COVID. Even though the zoo closed in November 23rd, 2020, the zoo, you know, the people that work there, the Department of Wildlife Health Services, came to the zoo every day and took care of the animals. Their job did not stop. They were in essence essential workers. You can't, you know, walk away and not feed a lion for 3 months. I mean, you're not going to have a lion when you come back. So
right. And if you open the cages, you'll have only a lion when you come back.
That's right.
Which, you know.
Absolutely.
I was fascinated by that, Patty, because I think a lot of Americans don't understand how federal government workers get labeled essential versus non-essential, right? Both Nia and I, our backgrounds in part are Homeland Security and Emergency Preparedness. You know, so from our perspective, essential workers are those that are providing, if you will, for national or homeland security, or respond specifically to a crisis, right?
Right.
What a lot of Americans don't understand is government at all levels have definitions of who are or are not essential government workers. And as you pointed out, once the government creates a program like a zoo, and you have living creatures that depend on government employees, okay, to live,
I like to think of them as other employees because they're also employees of the zoo, sort of.
Okay, but to the, yeah, well, yeah, good point. Okay, but.
But yeah, I mean.
You can't go ahead and say that somebody's not essential simply because they don't provide, you know, a national security purpose or a public safety purpose. I mean,
right.
Once the government makes an affirmative obligation to provide X, then the question is, if X exists, who then needs to go ahead and provide it? So when I was reading your notes, I was just like, but of course that makes sense. But a lot of us don't understand, you know, what is an essential government worker?
And
even within that agency, the person who takes your ticket at the front of the zoo probably didn't work. They were probably sent home, right?
Yeah, right.
But the person, but the vets and the people who take care of the animals are considered essential. So even within one agency, you might have partial essential and partial not essential, right? A tiered system of doing that.
And think about this. They have over 2,700 animals of 390 different species. So, I mean, that's a lot of mouths to feed. That's a lot of work to be done. So someone had to do it. And, you know, again, the zoo was closed. And so they were still there, you know, because the zoo is actually opening up again on May 21st. So, you know, they have to have a zoo to have a zoo there, and they have to have animals in the zoo. So someone had to take care of them. So, yeah.
Well, and is it all paid? Is everyone who works at the zoo paid?
Not at all. Actually, they have a huge volunteer corps, but since they shut down for COVID, they haven't had any volunteers. But normally, in a normal year, volunteers put in over 90,000 hours of work. So there's a ton of volunteers. And you know, they have a few requirements. They have to be over 18. They have to make a time commitment of a year. They have to actually fill out an application and get hired. And even have some vaccinations, which is kind of interesting to be a volunteer. But yeah, there's a huge volunteer corps, but that all went away when COVID hit, because they didn't want to have any, you know, risk factors there. So they sent all the volunteers home, and they just operated off of their, you know, just their care team. So yeah, that's huge. It's
Patty, you mentioned the volunteers need to get, or at least demonstrate proof of certain vaccinations. Mm-hmm. What would be an example of a vaccination that a volunteer would have to have?
Well, it doesn't really specify, but it depends on where you're going to work. So I think if you're working with exotic animals that may have come from different countries, there may be a need to get certain vaccinations for that. So they just said proof of certain vaccinations. So I think it really depends on where you end up working. I mean, again, if you're working in the gift shop, chances are you don't need a vaccination. but if you're working with a Gila monster, you might need a special vaccination. So.
And I'm assuming that the vaccinations they're talking about protect both you and the animal, right? There,
yes.
It's that sort of both way kind of, please don't give our animals some kind of cold that they then die from, because I know that zoo systems exchange animals, and they breed animals to try to broaden the DNA, like, mm-hmm. so that there's lots of strains of animals, and it's not just one pair that do all the breeding or whatever, which is one of the problems. I know you're going to talk about pandas later, but it's a big mm-hmm. problem with the pandas because there's only so many to start with. But also, I would assume that kind of stuff, that level of work is not done by volunteers. That level of work is done by the paid staff that are ongoing and long term, right? So what we're talking about with volunteers is probably feeding and cleaning and the things that can be done with basic training. I'm assuming you come in and they train you how to be around the animal or not be around the animal and clean up and all that other kind of stuff. So if somebody's interested in doing that, it's not super likely that they would put you in any sort of dangerous. You're in danger from the tourists. probably than you are from the animals.
Right. Yeah. Well, then the other thing too, there's also a second campus at the zoo. There's the Smithsonian Conservation Biology Institute, which is actually where some of this other work, this, you know, when they think about breeding programs and also, you know, helping endangered species. And so they're actually located in Front Royal, Virginia. And on this land, they not only have animals, but they have, you know, trees and shrubs and plants and everything else. So it's a really interesting place, but they do a lot of experiments there. They do a lot of care for endangered species. So that's kind of runs hand in hand with the zoo. And so that's where they do. And I'm sure that all of these decisions about, you know, moving an animal to a different location, those are probably not random decisions. I think there's a lot of thought that goes in there because they have to make sure that the animal is going to a place that can actually take care of it and, you know, have the right care and the right, you know, expertise to hold that. So,
I think want to have a tiger, but I can't really take care of one.
No.
So we know, National Zoo sending a tiger to my apartment is probably a bad idea.
You know, tell that to some people. Some people don't realize that.
Right. That's the other thing is I know that some zoos come to their animals from people who can no longer care for exotic animals.
Mm-hmm.
And just as a side note, if you're a person right now who owns an exotic animal and you're thinking about giving it to a zoo, please do. Please do that rather than putting it out. Right? Like, because because that's Florida has discovered that if you can no longer handle your 50-foot python, just throwing it out in the backyard is a terrible idea. Because apparently pythons lay lots and lots of eggs, and they make lots and lots of baby pythons. And now they're all over. I mean, it's like a thing, right? Because species, because other species, because your average, you know, animal from Florida has never laid eyes on a python. And the last thing it sees before it dies is a python. And they're like, and it probably says, "What was that?" as it's dying. Not so good. But anyway, yeah. I watched a documentary over a bit ago on carp in the Mississippi River. And now I'm all about, like, keep your invading species someplace else, because that's a terrible thing. Sorry, go ahead.
No, I just wanted to say that you're right, that there are a lot of places that take in, animals that have been, you know, they're struggling. One place that I'm very familiar with is Barizona in Williams, Arizona. And they started as a bear refuge. So they were there to, you know, bears that were struggling in the wild. And so they took them in, and they have, you know, it's just a beautiful place. But the funniest story, so I went there a couple of years ago. And, and it's like, I don't know if you've ever heard of Blind Country Safari, but you actually stay in your car and you drive through these areas where the animals are running wild. It's really cool. I mean, sometimes they jump on your car, not so cool, but anyway, or they stick their nose in your window, and that's not so good either, especially if they have teeth. But anyway, so we're driving through there, and it was really a cool, it's like a 2-mile thing, and they have all North American animals. So, you know, bears and bison and wolves and badgers and, you know, all kinds of stuff. Anyway, so we were talking to some of the people, and we said, hey, you know, the bears look all fat. I mean, they were not aggressive at all, because they were very well fed. You could tell they were kind of sitting there looking at us like, hey, there's another tourist, you know. And so we said, well, have you ever lost a bear? Has anyone ever left? And she goes, actually, we ended up having a bear that came in. So they go out to count the bears one day, and there's one extra. So a bear actually snuck in to the refuge. So they're pretty smart. They go, this looks pretty good.
This looks good.
I'm heading
free
over
food.
There. So.
Free food. I can watch the tourists go by, so there's entertainment. Like, you know,
I thought that was hysterical.
Sometimes
anyway.
I wonder. I have to admit, sometimes I wonder when I'm standing in a zoo if the animals perceive me as entertainment. You know what I mean? Like, if they're looking at me like, "Well, that's an interesting outfit," or "Nice purple hair you got there."
Well, I mean, and please forgive me reflecting the fact that I got a 9-year-old daughter, but you know, that's like part of the original plot of the Madagascar movies, right? For those of you who are not familiar, check out the Madagascar movies, because you're talking about a zoo in New York City where the zoo animals, okay, have certain impressions of the public that comes to view them, right? Okay, whereas my daughter was enjoying, you know, oh, hey, look at the cute little animals. Me, I was really enjoying the commentary of the animals about the public, right? I was just like, yeah, I wonder, you know, do they have these kinds of thoughts of all of us who are just standing there being entertained by them feeding their faces or, you know, scratching their butts, right? Or whatever the case may be, right?
Right.
Okay. But the idea, Patty, that a bear, okay, who was not part of the, you know, preserve, is just like, yeah, I'm tired of where I'm living and the grass is greener over there and look at how fat and happy those bears are. Yeah, I'm out of here, right?
Yeah.
Okay.
I could struggle in the wild. Yeah. Sorry, go ahead, Augie.
I'm voting with my feet.
Okay? Exactly. I could struggle in the wild, or I could go over there and hang out. Why would I stay here? Right? That just doesn't make any sense at all. I'm with the bear. So, okay. So does it cost to get into the zoo?
No, actually it's free. Again, part of the Smithsonian Institute. And so, you know, all those museums are free. So it's free to go to now in the post-COVID, as they reopen again on May 21st, they are asking people to, they have to actually go online and get an entry pass. They have to actually, you know, because they're trying to manage how many people are coming in. And then if you drive to the zoo, you have to pay $30 for parking, but that's for the whole car. I mean, you know, so if you have 25 people like a clown car, then that's a pretty good deal. You know?
That would be awesome. I can't remember what the cars are called. Miata pulls up and like 47 people get out of it. And like, holy cow.
Yeah, it's still $30. So, but they're really, you know, trying to manage how many people come in, but it is free. Yes.
And you could take the Metro out there if you didn't want to pay $30 to park, right? Doesn't the Metro go to the zoo?
It gets close.
Okay.
It gets very close to the zoo. And a lot of people do that. A lot of locals end up taking the Metro because they don't want to pay for parking. But they're trying to manage. I mean, they're reopening. I mean, it's like anything else, like Disneyland or anywhere else. They're trying to manage the crowd. So they're trying to, you know, figure out how many people, and they really, I don't think they have any numbers figured out yet, but they're taking reservations. So you have to have a reserve pass to get in, but it doesn't cost anything.
And for listeners who are thinking about museums, I happened to be in North Carolina recently, and the North Carolina Museum of Art is doing the same thing. So you might want to consider that if you're going to a free museum or park or something like that, you may need to go to their website and make sure that you don't have to at least reserve an entry pass, which I did have to reserve for the museum because they're only letting a certain number of people in at one time to help with distancing. Also, even though mask requirements are being relaxed, mm-hmm. the institution you may be going to may not be relaxed. So you would also want to check that.
As
a side note for anybody who may be traveling this summer, we're in that weird position or in that weird transition time where some places still are requiring masks and still requiring distancing and, just check before you go. Can you eat at the zoo? Well, animals can eat at the zoo, and you can't eat animals at the zoo. But can you eat human food at the zoo?
You can, but only in designated areas. Again, you know, we're talking post-COVID, so everything's a little different. I mean, instead of just, you know, you can't walk around with, you know, eating now, you have to eat only in designated areas. So yeah, it's a little more controlled than it used to be, but yeah, you can, they have places to eat. They have several of the restaurants are open, so. That's good. I also wanted to say that the other thing is if you go to the zoo, you can't automatically go see the pandas. You actually have to request an Asia pass to go to that specific area where the pandas are. So you not only if you want to go to the zoo, you have to reserve your spot, you know, to get in, but you also have to reserve a spot to see the pandas. So they're really trying to manage, you know, to control the number of people because they don't, you know, want to get the pandas sick or anything. So, yeah.
So that would be, okay, so that reflects what? One, how popular viewing the pandas actually are, but two, is there something about the transmission of COVID and what it could do to the pandas?
That wasn't specified in this, but they did make a point if you go to the website to say, by the way, if you want to see the pandas, you have to do this extra step. Yeah. Okay. So I think it's crowd control. I think there might be some issues with, you know, concern about transmission, but there was nothing said explicitly about that. They just said that you need to, but I think that's true anyway. I think if you go to the zoo, you know, pre-COVID, that you still had to do this extra step to see the pandas. So they're really trying to manage that view, but you have the panda camp. So, you don't need to, you don't always have to go. You can do the panda camp. So.
Well, and I wonder if in part that may also be something that the Chinese government put into place, right, as a sort of a control measure there as well, because they are so rare and hard to breed. Mm-hmm. Like baby pandas are a really celebrated thing because they're so unusual one, that you can get a baby panda, and two, that they live.
Yeah, that's true.
So they're, you know, is the zoo ADA compliant?
It is. And so if you are planning on going to the zoo, you know, after May 21st, you, when you go and get your pass, you put in there that you need accommodations. And so when you show up, you have to show that you have an accommodation on your pass. And then they have all different ways of accommodating, you know, wheelchairs and you know, if they have documentation that's printed differently and, you know, larger. So there's a lot of accommodations that they make, but you have to specify. They won't automatically just, you know, you can't just walk in there and say, hey, I need this, I need that. You have to actually specify ahead of time. So that's kind of interesting. But I think we're still kind of adjusting to the post-COVID. So that may change, but that's what they ask you to do now. So.
You know what? In Nia, back to your question, is the National Zoo ADA compliant? I remember when the ADA was being considered by the United States Congress, and they actually did a study before Congress actually voted on the ADA as what would be the impact of ADA on, you know, businesses, government, etc. And one of the studies that was done by, I want to say, the Office of Management and Budget was what would be the potential cost to retrofit the National Zoo to make it ADA compliant. Okay.
Listeners, if I can find that document, I'll.
Yeah.
I'll add it to the research guide.
Because that was one of the more interesting things about the debate about the Americans with Disabilities Act was, you know, what would be the cost to make various, if you will, institutions, structures, et cetera, compliant. And, you know, places like zoos, museums, okay, where you have, you know, I mean, the idea is to get the public to come, right?
Right.
So how do you go ahead and make that compliant? Okay.
Right.
Patty, a few moments ago, you mentioned the Panda Cam. And Nia and I are both fascinated by the fact that they have various cameras that all you got to do is just go onto the zoo's website. And you can, so how many of these cameras are we talking about? And in because I would think that you would get a lot of viewers for certain animals, but, you know, is there any kind of logic or, you know?
Yeah, that's a really good question. I don't know, because they have four cams that you can watch on the website. And the most popular, obviously, is the Panda Cam. They're adorable. But sometimes they say in the cam, and I actually went on and looked at it, they hide. They actually are not very nice. Sometimes they go, neener, neener, I'm going to hide behind the tree. So you can't see them. So they're not, you know, always willing to accommodate when someone wants to watch them. But there's actually a lion cam, which I think would be interesting, and an elephant cam. And then there's a naked mole rat cam, which I don't know who, I think that must be a political decision, because this animal, we talk about, he's not the most easy on the eyes, I guess that's what I would say. And, you know, and I think we all can find things to like about lions, and we can find things to like about elephants and pandas, but
it must be political.
Well, I mean, why would you pick the naked mole rat cam? I mean, why wouldn't you pick a badger or a prairie dog or something, a bison? I mean, really?
Something cute. Like it. So we need to find, Augie, we need to find whose district the mole rat comes from. Because that person is super powerful in Congress. And like, you know what I want? I want a cam on a mole rat. I was going to ask you if there were cams
sit on the Smithsonian board, right?
It is dubious. I think we have to kind of, you know, think about why that the cam is on the naked mole rats. So,
but that's a good point, though. That brings up a good point, which is, you know, all of the wildlife conservation groups choose cute animals to be their mascots, right? That the WWF has the panda on it. Mm-hmm. And a lot of them choose pandas or elephants or whales, right? Something that's pretty or majestic, or hardly any of them choose something like the naked mole rat, right? Or or something else. But those animals also need to be conserved. Like mm-hmm. biosphere yeah, isn't just the adorable animals. It's also yeah. the animals that aren't adorable, but contribute to the overall.
Yeah, why doesn't it, you know, a wildlife group have, you know, the jackal, okay? Right. A razorback, right?
Right. Right. Or a wolverine, one of the most violent things on the earth, right? They don't dare, they're like, let's conserve these. Let's conserve them pretty far away from people, but let's conserve yeah. them, right?
Like or a wild, think of a wild boar. I mean, you know, right. yeah.
Yeah. The whole idea of that is, I think, is fascinating that they choose the sort of cuddly ones because those sell in the gift shop. Right. Those are the ones that kids don't like. When's the last time your daughter said to you, Augie, Daddy, I like this mole rat. Can you give me this mole rat as a, you know?
Never.
Right.
Nope. Nope.
Nope.
Right.
Nope.
And we've discussed that she likes sloths, but she likes sloths because in Ice Age, they're cute.
Yeah. Yeah. In the movie series Ice Age, the sloth is, a somewhat adorable character and played very well by an actor who Nia, like you, I can't say his last name, John
Leguizamo.
Okay, thank you.
Very good. Thank you, Patty. you're correct.
But real sloths are covered in lice and moss and they're super slow and they're really...
Yes.
Not particularly adorable. They're kind of green because they're covered in moss. And there's this sort of, so, but they don't show you that one. The one in the gift shop is adorable and cute and fuzzy and all that other kind of stuff. Yeah, I get that zoos have to sell themselves, right? They have to sell the animals in some way. So they, and part of that is because visiting the zoo and the gift shop and all that other kind of stuff, I'm sure helps to finance some of what goes on at the Smithsonian. And so you have to do the adore, but I do like that there is a naked mole rat cam. I'm probably not going to watch it, but I like that one exists.
Well,
out there who are mad because you love naked mole rats and I've just talked them down, I'm sorry.
But I mean,
you're entitled think about to like what, ugly things as much as you want.
But think about when the pandemic hit. I mean, my daughter and I, when, you know, we were, you know, on the fly converting to at home virtual learning, you know, to get her head out of a tablet, okay, you know, I would go ahead and she and I would watch you know, cameras of animals at zoos. Okay. And it led her to ask a whole bunch of questions about a whole bunch of animals where I didn't know the answers. And it was a teaching moment because I would say, okay, so let's look it up. Right.
Yeah.
Cause you know, I wouldn't know, right. You know, I didn't know how long it took, you know, baby condors to, you know, emerge from, you know, the egg, okay, and be able to actually, like, do things on their own.
They have big feet.
They do have big feet.
They're born with huge feet, and then they grow into them.
Yes.
Which I don't...
Yeah, but those cameras, okay, and we actually did spend a little bit of time, Patty, with the National Zoo Panda Cam. And most of the time, they did hide. part of it was trying to figure, you know, trying to guess where actually the pandas were. Okay. Yes.
So
yes,
we alluded to this earlier, but the National Zoo does not own the pandas, mm-hmm. right? Mm-mm. The pandas are on loan.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
They are. Yeah, it actually started way back in 1972, and the first two pandas were given to the Nixons, and they donated them to the zoo. And so there's been, obviously, since 72, several iterations. As you know, pandas died, they would get more. And so the interesting thing is, when a panda is born at the zoo, and as you mentioned earlier, a lot of them are born dead. It's very hard to have a live baby, you know, panda, and have it survive. But if they do, and they've had several now, that they have to relocate to China after they're 4 years old. So that's the deal is, you know, we give you these pandas, you do all this care and feeding, but when they turn four, they have to go back to China. So
okay, can I just say that is a terrible immigration policy? That panda is American. That panda should have the right to be here if it wants to be here. It's never been to China, so it's not going back. It's going to a whole new country with whole new people speaking a whole new language. And yeah. If we think that animals don't get used, by the way, to the cadences of language, they do. If you've ever visited another country and listened to people tell their dog commands, they say it in whatever language they live, and the dog responds. So dogs hear language, I'm sure pandas hear language, and I'm sure that at four, they're used to English, they're used to whatever they've been listening to, and then all of a sudden they that's not cool.
That's the agreement. That's it's an agreement with the China Wildlife Conservation Association.
Yeah, and I guess there's no way to sneak around and like.
No, it's a pretty big deal when a baby panda is born. I mean, we all can't. Go absolutely crazy. So, you know.
And of course, the political scientists in me are like, you know, Nia, you know, this is an example of you know soft power. Okay, international relations. It was a big deal. When China gave the pandas to the Nixons, okay? You know, that was part of, you know, Nixon reaching out to the communist Chinese government. So, yeah, I mean, and, you know, and it has political overtones. I mean, that would be a major affront to the Chinese people and government if a baby panda was born here in the United States and at 4 years old, we said, yeah, sorry, we're keeping it.
Yeah.
It's asked for sanctuary and it's staying here. And we're not sending it to China. I can imagine that would stop the entire rest of the program. Like whatever pandas we had in the country at that point would be the only pandas we would ever see again. Because
probably, yeah.
I'm sure that lots of feathers would get ruffled or lots of fur would get rubbed, and that would not be not be acceptable.
Yeah. But something else I want to share is that the two pandas that are there now, and I can't pronounce their names, Mei Zhang and Tian Tian, they're actually on loan and they have to go back in 2023 to China.
So will more pandas, or is that up in the air?
That's the
agreement
in the air.
Is only through 2023. Oh, yep. No.
Yeah.
So if we don't fly right, we might not get more pandas.
That's right.
Yeah, oh, then there's Augie's diplomacy.
Yeah, we may be pandaless. Yep.
Oh no. No, yep. That's really sad because, well, and I'm assuming that part of all of that is, not to be ugly, but the pandas draw in a lot of people and make a lot of money, right? Like, yeah. Because yeah. They sell, there's a lot of things that go along with that. So there's a lot of layers of diplomacy there that would need to be managed. Oh my goodness. Okay, well, I need to write a letter to President Biden and say, be nice to China.
I think he already sure. is.
Okay, we need to make sure.
I think
not...
they have him in the bag. I just
on the panda issue. Good. Okay, so
wait, but just stop for a moment. Imagine the conversation that would go on in the Oval Office Okay, from the president's, you know, foreign affairs team, okay, the director of the CIA, the national security director. Okay, Mr. President, we need to talk about the pandas. Right.
What pandas? The pandas at the zoo. We need to make sure.
You know, we know, you know, you've been dealing with the pandemic. Okay, the malware attack on our petroleum pipeline, okay, a sluggish economy, yada, yada, yada. But we just need to make you aware that before your term is up, we have the panda issue, okay?
Yeah, we need to keep that. We need to keep that on the list. Can you imagine? Yeah. He's like, really, we need to keep this on the list? Yes, sir, because we cannot be without pandas.
I mean, no, you want to talk about a West Wing episode? Okay.
That would be
panda
a good one.
Issue.
That would be a good, that'd be a good one. Also, you know, sir, if we don't give them back in 2023, we're going to have a war. So yeah. Can you imagine the great panda war of 2023 where, like, oh my goodness, that can't happen. If I was president, I would not want that on my watch. No. So you made a note in your notes, and I just adore it because it's so very you. For listeners who don't know, Patty is a collections librarian, and that's a very specific kind of librarian. They sort of decide what goes into the library. And so what books are on the shelf, what things we buy, right? How we spend our money, because we only have a certain amount of money and we have to be careful to try to get as broad a treatment of a subject as possible, right? So there are collections librarians who spend a lot of time working on that. That's a lot of time, their whole job. Their whole job is that. So I noticed that you had a comment in here about curating the animals, which I thought, how very Patty, that to ask yourself the question of how do they decide which animals go into the zoo, right? Like that's an interesting question, and I don't know if there's even an answer. Is there even an answer to that question?
There really isn't. I mean, they are guided by a strategic plan, you know, and their real focus is conservation and saving endangered species. So there's a interest in kind of, you know, when those kinds of animals become available, they are probably at the top of the list that we're going to take them in and you know, because we want to conserve them. We want to make sure that they breed and that they grow and that the population doesn't get decimated. But there really isn't I couldn't find like a list of, you know, top 10, you know, animals that we want to bring into the zoo. You know, I mean, like, you know, who's the most popular animal we want to bring in? But I think a lot of it is, I mean, it's opportunity. I mean, when, you know, they find certain things or someone brings it to their attention, hey, we have this particular animal or breed, or, you know, it's endangered and we have this opportunity, that would be something that they would consider. But it's taken through this kind of strategic plan and how they look at, you know, what they want to provide, you know, as part of the zoo. But the real issue, I mean, their real focus, because, and I think it's because it's a Smithsonian institution, is conservation. It really is about conserving the, you know, the breeds and the endangered species and really being just excellent caretakers of the animals. And so I think that's really their driving force of who they, what they bring into the zoo and what, you know, and then, you know, we know that things die, right? I mean, right. Famous animals have died in zoos and we're all very depressed. It's very sad, you know, when some famous animal dies and so they want to avoid that. They don't want to, you know, they don't want to have any incidents if they can, you know, with what they do with these animals. So it's an interesting question, but I don't think there's a real good answer.
Well, I'm intrigued by the idea of provenance, because I know that you as a collections librarian, if somebody came to you and they said, I just happen to have this Gutenberg Bible that I'd like to sell the library, you'd be like, really? Where'd you get that Gutenberg Bible? And they'd say, I found it on a doorstep, right? Like, and then you would say, excuse me, I have to make a brief phone call to the police to come get you for having stolen a Gutenberg Bible, right?
Right.
So part of, I assume, zoos don't deal in black market Like, if suddenly somebody called the National Zoo and said, hey, man, I got a panda, you want it? Like, they would say, oh, heck no, we don't want your panda, because it didn't come through legitimate channels, right? So
right,
I'm assuming that part of what limits their conservation is that they have to know that the animal came to them in an honest way, as opposed to, because I know around the world black market animal dealings are huge, right? That people trade in animals all the time that shouldn't be traded in, partly for endangered animals, but also partly for dangerous animals, right? You shouldn't just be trading in certain animals. So yeah. I'm assuming that also limits their ability to get a hold of something.
Yeah, and think about like any art museum, like VMFA, right? You know, someone comes to them and says, I have a Picasso, right? you know, come to my doorstep and look at my Picasso. Well, it's the same kind of scrutiny. I mean, like you said, the word providence, I think, is a really good word, because like any museum, like any, you know, they have a standard where it has to be, they have to be able to kind of show providence and where they got this and, you know, who had it, because yeah, there's always that fear or that, you know, issue of, is this coming to us in a way that isn't, you know, legitimate or legal or safe or whatever. So yeah, I would, you know, the way they do it is probably very much like any kind of museum or any institution that has fine art. I mean, the Smithsonian, right? I mean, they're not going to take anything, you know, just anything can't show up in the Smithsonian. They have, you know, ways of curating and checking the provenance. I want to put this in the Smithsonian.
Right. So you don't have stolen stuff in there that somebody was walking by and says, hey, that's mine.
That's mine.
Well, and we know that in the art world, things have been stolen and sold and then had to be returned to the original owner. And whoever bought it is just out the money because you bought a stolen thing. And, you know. So if any of our students are thinking about somehow going to China and picking up a panda out of the wild and bringing it back to the National Zoo, please don't.
Please don't. Yes.
Please don't. Probably, because they will say to you, oh my goodness, that's not a good thing. They'll take it in, but then you'll go to jail and the panda will go back to China. So maybe don't do that. Also, can I make a side note for our listeners who might want to think about crawling over the fence and getting their picture taken with a jaguar or some other animal? Please don't.
Don't do it.
Please don't, for two reasons. One, you are going to get legitimately mauled and it will be your fault, right? And that's not good. But also, they will put the animal down in many cases.
Yeah.
And that's not fair to the animal. You walked into its pen, it did what animals do, and now it's getting punished for that. Fortunately, the jaguar that I mentioned did not get put down, but that was only through massive public intervention in that case, because a woman climbed over the fence and wanted to have her selfie with a jaguar. And that's just not... Like, really, people, let's not do that. Let's not engage in climbing over any fences. So we'd like to just put that out there as a warning.
Yeah, just as a side note, I mean, that's one of the most deaths in national parks these days are from people taking selfies and falling off cliffs. Just a side note, seriously.
Yeah. Yeah.
Well, I mean, and I think one of the great values of zoos, and I've long believed this, is it forces humans to understand that not everything is about them, right? Mm. So, you know, don't hop the fence to go ahead and get a great selfie, right? Because it isn't about you, okay? Mm-hmm. You know, one of the purposes of zoos is to understand that we are sharing this earth with other creatures, okay, who are beautiful, or depending on your perspective, okay, this is in, you know, Patty's notes, okay, they may be ugly to you, but to somebody else, they're just utterly fascinating and beautiful creatures, right?
Right.
So, you know, it's kind of sort of like You know, we talked about this in a previous podcast episode, you know, about parks, right? You know, Patty, you just mentioned, you know, deaths that occur at, you know, national parks because people are taking, you know, selfies and they fall off a cliff, right? Okay, understand that, you know, when you're on this big, huge mountain, okay, you're inconsequential.
Right.
Right.
The okay? cliff does not care.
Yeah, the cliff doesn't care. The cliff was there before you. It will be there.
It will clearly be there after you.
After you, et cetera, right? So to understand that it's not necessarily always about you, right? Okay.
Right. Exactly.
You know, the mama elephant that's taking care of the baby elephant, okay, doesn't care about you, okay? And whether or not you're staring at them, okay,
yes.
is irrelevant.
And okay? if you get up close to her baby, she will rightfully stomp you into the ground.
Yes.
Because she is protecting her baby, just like if an elephant got too close to your baby, you yes. would snatch up your baby and protect it. Like, unless you're the world's worst parent, you would, you know what I mean? Like you guys are both parents. So you would know what I mean. Like you would protect your kids.
Yeah.
Cause that's what yeah. you do. And that's what they're doing. That's the natural instinct for every animal is to protect its offspring. So the other thing that I think is important to mention here is, the cost of something like the international breeding program that they do, right, where they don't they have agreements with other institutions? They do.
In countries, yeah. They have one now with Japan with the giant salamander, Japanese giant salamanders, and they're given to the zoo and they're doing some long-term breeding with those creatures. So yeah, they have different things going on at different times.
The cost of that is in my opinion, worth it because we are losing species by the minute. I mean, we're just because of the way humans use the earth or maneuver in the earth, but also just naturally animals die out. And so us trying to help that not happen seems like it's really worth the effort. I saw in your notes about the salamander and I thought, I'm not a particularly huge fan of salamanders, but I'm sure that salamanders are important, not only to people who love salamanders, but also to
the ecosystem,
certain ecosystem. Yeah. And yeah. so mm-hmm. hence why, if you decide you want to go to Joshua National Park, please don't knock over the trees. Hello, they're part of the ecosystem, right? And that's, again, part of the plant thing of zoos, right? Like a lot of times in zoos, you'll see plants that are being bred or protected in the zoo as well as part of the foliage or whatever that the animal needs.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And all that that kind of stuff. But is there you said earlier there was a special plant collection.
Right.
That's part
The Smithsonian Conservation Biology Institute in Front Royal, Virginia has actually, they do on this land have a number of, they have like 180 species of trees. They have 850 species of woody shrubs. They have,
which,
you know,
plants. I thought there were like six kinds of shrubs. So
yeah.
Here's what I know.
Yeah. Yeah. And they actually have 36 different species of bamboo. So
whoa. I mean, okay.
Dude, who knew?
Whoa.
Who knew?
Okay. warning to our listeners. Do not plant bamboo in your yard. Apparently bamboo is an invasive species that will take over not only your yard, but all the yards within about 100-mile radius of your home and
yes.
your neighbors will hate you. There is my PSA because we've had several people in the library. I said one day, I'd love to plant bamboo in my yard, which was a huge mistake because apparently that is a terrible species that will take over kudzu, right? Things that weren't meant to be where they are go out, get out of hand.
This was a few years ago at a different house that I was that I'm currently living in. I went to Home Depot, okay, and I said, you know, hey, how easy, difficult is it to go ahead and plant bamboo, okay? And like five people at the Home Depot in their lawn and garden section, okay, like came to me in mass.
Pounced on you.
Okay, and we're like, sir, we don't recommend anybody do that in the Richmond area. And I was just like, did I say something wrong? Is there like, you know, is there a state law against this? And they're just like, it will destroy your yard, your neighbor's yard. Okay. And I was just like, I did not know this. And they're like, may we recommend some less invasive? And I said, no. Let's talk about shrubs. And there, and then Nia, they were like, well, we have well over like 20 different types of shrubs. And I'm like, there's over 20 different.
I'm there's like, 850.
Yeah. I was just like, what are you talking about? Right.
Yeah. And they're that's amazing.
Yes. Yeah. Oh yeah. 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 Yeah.
Yeah. Well, and in Patty's notes for people who can't read them, there are 40 species of grass, which I think is hilarious because I'm like grass, you know, green stuff, right? Like, that's amazing to me. And of course, biologists who are listening to this are just banging their heads against desks going, of course there's 40 species. There's way more than that or whatever. But yeah, I guess the thing with bamboo is they make really long roots that run under stuff. So you plant a bamboo in one spot and you're like, ah, my bamboo. And then behind you about 40 feet, it pops up and you're like, oh, more bamboo. And then pretty soon it's like pop, 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 pop. And it's all over the neighborhood.
It's terrible for house foundations. It will
and driveways.
Yeah, it will destroy the root systems for trees.
And plumbing. Yeah.
Oh, and plumbing. Oh,
yep, don't forget about the plumbing. So
if you're not living in on the East Coast, right? And you're not living in the DC area, you can look at the CAMs and get animals there. But there are other zoos of note in the world, as Augie said, in other countries. So if you're listening to us from other countries, check out your own national zoo. You probably have one or something along those lines. If you don't have a national zoo, you have probably a well-known zoo. But you mentioned Verrazona, which I think is great for the name, right? Verrazona. Are there any other that you want to throw a mention out to before we wrap up?
Well, I looked at, where in the scheme of things, where the National Zoo came in on the world, and it came in 17th place of the best zoos in the world. So that's pretty good when you're thinking of the world. So that's pretty good. And then it's the sixth best zoo in the USA. So I think that's kind of interesting. But yeah, Verrazona was on that list. Gatorland, which is something that would never come to my mind in Florida. they have a huge park there that, you know, that preserves crocodiles and alligators. And then, of course, you know, San Diego.
They do shows. Gatorland does shows, by the way, in case you want. Fascinating wrestling shows and all kinds of stuff like that, if you want to see people wrestle alligators. Yeah. Anyway, I'm sorry, you were saying San Diego.
No, I was just going to San Diego has the Wild Animal Park, which is kind of where you can take your car and a train, and you can kind of travel through the different terrains. And then they mentioned the SeaWorld, and we have to kind of remember that there's also these aquariums and places that marine animals. Yeah. So
a lot of cities, Baltimore apparently has a really nice aquarium as well, if you're here on the East Coast.
Yeah. So lots of good choices. I mean, if you love animals, I mean, there's something for everybody. And even, you know, the rat,
the naked mole rat.
Rats, so yes.
Can we end on one of my favorite ever memories from my childhood, which is Mutual of Omaha's Wild Kingdom?
Okay.
Where Jim, the guy Jim, who was out in the wild. So Marlon Perkins was the host of this show, for young people who have never heard what I'm talking about. Marlon Perkins was this older guy who wore a suit and he had gray hair, and he would say, you know, and he would show a map, and then he would show where the animal was on the map, right? Here is the, I don't know, here's the lion in the Serengeti, right? And then he would show you where that was. And then he would say, now Jim is going to show us the lion in its natural habitat. And Jim, I don't remember what Jim's last name was, unfortunately. He worked at the San Diego Zoo after he was no longer on this show. And then they would show this film of Jim being half eaten by a lion, trying to like wrestle it so that he could show you its head or its mane or its whatever, you know what I mean? And he's like, are you okay, Jim? And Jim's like, yeah, I'm fine. I've been got. And it was this great, but it was, when I was a kid, it was this sort of wonderful view into part of what I didn't know then, but what I know now, is part of what they were doing was conservation. That was part of what they were sort of, that was the non-business side of Mutual of Omaha, which is an insurance company. But anyway, that guy went on to be in the San Diego Zoo, and he would go into Hollywood onto the Tonight Show or other shows and bring animals. And right. So you still see that some on, I think Jimmy Kimmel still does it occasionally, and some of the other shows. So you can find some of those on YouTube if you want to see some of those animals being interacted with, because now other people from the San Diego Zoo also do that, bring animals. And Steve Irwin used to do that. He would go on shows and bring animals, that kind of thing. I say that if you're looking for a natural reaction from some of the hosts, because sometimes they would hand them an animal and they clearly did not want to be holding this naked mole rat or whatever it is. They're like, can I hand this back at any moment? And the person who works it from the zoo is saying, look, he's just nibbling on you because he loves you or whatever. And the host is like, oh, I don't want to do this anymore. But a lot of that is on YouTube.
For me, the best reactions, and again, I'm dating myself here, Johnny Carson.
Yes. Oh, yeah. Yeah, oh, that's what I was thinking of.
Monkeys on his head, the little spider monkey on his head is one of the most famous of his, where he's just sitting there with the spider monkey.
Yeah, because Carson filmed in L.A., so you'd always have people up from the San Diego Zoo, right? Okay.
Yeah.
And Johnny Carson was known for, the king of cool, right? I mean, he was the king of late night. But, you know, the rep from the San Diego Zoo would go ahead and bring these animals, right? And all of a sudden, Johnny Carson would just be losing it. Okay.
Yeah, it was great.
And the rep from the San Diego Zoo would be like, okay, but Johnny, there's, you know, like Nia just mentioned, the animal obviously loves you, and Johnny Carson is just like, can we please go to commercial, right?
Oh yeah.
For the love of God, get this animal away from my neck, okay, that seems to be burrowing a hole there, right? Okay.
But the reason I bring it up is because it was educational.
Part
of what Mutual of Omaha, that was on Sunday evenings, and that was educational. It came on before another show that was meant for children, which was Disney Wide World of, no, something of Disney. And they were intended to be educational. Same with those late night spots. What you'll find is while the host is holding on to it, the curator is actually talking about the animal. They're talking about where it comes from and what its characteristics are. It was very educational. So that's the other thing I wanted to throw out there about zoos, is that the tendency, if you go on one of the tours, is that there is an educational component. Somebody is going to talk to you about the history of the animal and how it came to be at the zoo, but also what its natural habitat is and what it, you know, all of those kinds of things. So they can be marvelous opportunities for children to learn about where animals live and how they live.
Well, yeah, before COVID, I mean, kids used to take field trips to zoos. I mean, when I was a kid, we did that all the time. We went, to the local zoos and stuff. And that was part of it, was just to get exposure to different animals and learn something, and it was great. I mean, I loved it. So yeah, there's lots of opportunity.
Exactly. It goes back to Augie's point of you're not alone on the planet and you have to conserve, you have to think about the other animals that are here as well.
Yes.
So thank you so much.
I wanted to say one final story is when I was in Galapagos, the animals ruled. So we're standing on this rock and this iguana who runs the joint comes over and he actually steps over my boot. And it's like, you just have to sit there and the guy is like, he's in charge and he's just like strolling along. And it's like, yeah, I get that. You're in charge. Okay. So very humbling. So yes.
Cool. Thank you so much, Patty, for coming and visiting with us today and talking about the zoo.
This was great. I loved it. Loved the conversation. So thank you. Thank you for having me.
Yeah, I really appreciate all the knowledge, but again, the enthusiasm. It's quite obvious just listening to you how important going to zoos and what they've meant to you.
Absolutely.
I can't speak for Nia about this, but definitely for me, anybody who's smart and enthusiastic about, you know, a passion in their life, always have a place on our podcast. So
yep.
Anytime you want to come back and share your knowledge and your enthusiasm about something else, please do so.
Yep. Okay. Thank you.
Thank you.
Appreciate that.
Love to have you.
Yeah. Yeah. Cool. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
You've been listening to Civil Discourse, brought to you by VCU Libraries. Opinions expressed are solely the speaker's own and do not reflect the views or opinions of VCU or VCU Libraries. Special thanks to the workshop for technical assistance. Music by Isaac Hobson. Find more information at guides.library.vcu.edu/discourse. As always, no documents were harmed in the making of this podcast.